that the reptiles probably didn't notice the fence at all. It was known locally as the world's largest turtle bordello. With that out of the way, whatever other wildlife existed at Fort Irwin seemed quite able to look after itself. The occasional coyote appeared and disappeared, and that was that. Besides, coyotes were not endangered. The visitors were. Fort Irwin was home to the Army's National Training Center. The permanent residents of that establishment were the OPFOR, the opposing force. Originally two battalions, one of armor and the other of mechanized infantry, the OPFOR had once styled itself the 32nd Guards Motor Rifle Regiment, a Soviet designation, because at its opening in the 1980s, the NTC had been designed to teach the U.S. Army how to fight, survive, and prevail in a battle against the Red Army on the plains of Europe. The soldiers of the 32nd, dressed in Russian-style uniforms, drove Soviet-like equipment. The real Russian vehicles had proved too difficult to maintain, and American gear had been modified to Soviet shapes. Employed Russian tactics, and took pride in kicking the hell out of the units that came to play on their turf. It wasn't strictly fair. The OPFOR lived here and trained here, and hosted regular units up to 14 times per year, whereas the visiting team might be lucky to come here once in 4 years. But nobody had ever said war was fair. Times had changed with the demise of the Soviet Union, but the mission of the NTC had not. The OPFOR had recently been enlarged to 3 battalions, now called squadrons, because the unit had assumed the identity of the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, the Black Horse Cav, and simulated brigade or larger enemy formations. The only real concession to the new political world was that they didn't call themselves Russians anymore. Now they were Krasnovians, a word, however, derived from Krasny, Russian for red. General Lieutenant Gennady Yosefovich Bondarenko knew most of this. The turtle bordello was something on which he'd not been briefed. His initial tour of the base had taken care of that, however, and was as excited as he had ever been. "You started in Signal Corps?" Diggs asked. The base commander was terse of speech and efficient of movement, dressed in desert camouflage fatigues called chocolate chip from their pattern. He, too, had been fully briefed, though, like his visitor, he had to pretend that he hadn't been.
"Correct," Bondarenko nodded. "But I kept getting into trouble. First Afghanistan, then when the Mujah raided into Soviet Union. They attacked the defense research facility in Tajik when I was visitor there. Brave fighters, but unevenly led. We managed to hold them off," the Russian reported in a studied monotone. Diggs could see the decorations that had resulted. He had commanded a cavalry squadron leading Barry McCaffrey's 24th Mechanized Infantry Division in a wild ride on the American left during Desert Storm, then gone on to command the 10th Buffalo ACR, still based in the Negev Desert, as part of America's commitment to Israeli security. Both men were 49. Both had smelled the smoke. Both were on the way up.
"You have country like this at home?" Diggs asked. "We have every sort of terrain you can imagine. It makes training a challenge, especially today."
"There," he said, "it started."
The first group of tanks was rolling now, down a broad U-shaped pass called the Valley of Death. The sun was setting behind the brown-colored mountains, and darkness came rapidly here. Scuttling around also were the Humvees of the observer controllers, the gods of the NTC, who watched everything and graded what they saw as coldly as death himself. The NTC was the world's most exciting school. The two generals could have observed the battle back at base headquarters in a place called the Star Wars Room. Every vehicle was wired, transmitting its location, direction of movement, and when the time came, where it was shooting and whether it scored a hit or not. From that data, the computers at Star Wars sent out signals telling people when they had died, though rarely why. That fact they learned later from the observer controllers. The generals didn't want to watch computer screens, however. Bondarenko's staff officers were doing that, but the place for their general was here. Every battlefield had a smell, and generals had to have the nose for it.
Your instrumentation is like something from a science novel.
Dig shrugged. Not much changed from 15 years ago. We have more TV cameras on the hilltops now, though. America would be selling much of that technology to the Russians. That was a little hard for Diggs to accept. He'd been too young for Vietnam. His was the first generation of flag officers to have avoided that entanglement. But Diggs had grown up with one reality in his life, fighting the Russians in Germany. A cavalry officer for his entire career, he'd trained to be in one of the forward-deployed regiments, really augmented brigades, to make first contact. Diggs could remember a few times when it had seemed pretty damned likely that he'd find his death in the Fulda Gap, facing somebody like the man standing next to him, with whom he'd killed a six-pack the night before over stories of how turtles reproduced.
"In," Bondarenko said with a sly grin.
Somehow the Americans thought Russians were humorless. He had to correct that misimpression before he left. Diggs counted 10 before his deadpan reply.
Out.
10 more seconds.
In.
Then both started laughing. When first introduced to the favorite base joke, it had taken half a minute for Bondarenko to get it. But the resulting laughter had ended up causing abdominal pain. He recovered control and pointed.
This is the way war should be.
It gets pretty tense. Wait and see.
You use our tactics.
That was plain from the way the reconnaissance screen deployed across the valley.
Diggs turned.
Why not? They work for me in Iraq.
The scenario for this night, the first engagement for the training rotation, was a tough one. Red force in the attack, advance to contact, and eliminate the Blue Force reconnaissance screen. The Blue Force, in this case, was a brigade of the 5th Mechanized Division conducting hasty defense. The overall idea was that this was a very fluid tactical situation. The 11th ACR was simulating a division attack on a newly arrived force one-third its theoretical size. It was really the best way to welcome people to the desert, let them eat dirt.
Let's get moving.
Diggs hopped back into his Humvee, and the driver moved off to a piece of high ground called the Iron Triangle. A short radio message from his senior OC made the American general growl.
God damn it.
Problem?
General Diggs held up a map. That hill is the most important piece of real estate in the valley, but they didn't see it.
Well, they're going to pay for that little misjudgment. Happens every time.
Already the OP4 had people racing for the unoccupied summit.
To push that far that fast, is it prudent for Blue?
General, it sure as hell ain't prudent not to, as you will see.
Why hasn't he spoken more often, appeared in public more?
The intelligence chief could have said many things. President Ryan was undoubtedly busy, so many things to do. The government of his country was in shambles, and before he could speak, he had to organize it. He had a state funeral to plan. He had to speak to numerous foreign governments to give them the usual assurances. He had to secure things, not the least of which was his own personal safety. The American cabinet, the president's principal advisers, was gone and had to be reconstituted, but that was not what he wanted to hear.
"We have been researching this, Ryan," was the answer given.
Mainly from newspaper stories, a lot of them, faxed from his government's UN mission.
He has made few public speeches before this day, and then only to present the thoughts of his masters. He was an intelligence officer, actually an inside man, an analyst, evidently a good one, but an inside person.
So why did Derling elevate him so?
That was in the American papers yesterday. Their government requires a vice-presidential presence. Derling also wanted someone to firm up his international affairs team. And in this Ryan had some experience.
He performed well, remember, in their conflict with Japan.
An assistant, then, not a leader.
Correct. He has never aspired to high office. Our information is that he agreed to the second post as a caretaker for less than a year.
I am not surprised.
Daryai looked at the notes. Assistant to Vice Admiral James Greer, the DDI-CIA. Briefly, the acting DDI. Then Deputy Director of Central Intelligence. Then National Security Advisor to President Derling. Finally, he'd accepted the temporary post of Vice President. His impressions of this Ryan person had been correct from the very beginning. A helper. Probably a skilled one, as he himself had skilled assistants, none of whom, however, could assume his own duties. He was not dealing with an equal.
Good. What else?
As an intelligence specialist, he will be unusually well informed of foreign affairs. In fact, his knowledge of such things may be the best America has had in recent years, but at the cost of near ignorance of domestic issues, the briefing officer went on. This tidbit had come from the New York Times.
Ah.
And with that bit of information, the planning started. At this point, it was merely a mental exercise, but that would soon change.
So, how are things in your army? Diggs asked.
The two generals stood alone atop the principal terrain feature, watching the battle play out below them with low-light viewing gear. As predicted, the 32nd, Bondarenko had to think of them that way, had overwhelmed the Blue Force reconnaissance screen, maneuvered to the left, and was now rolling up the enemy brigade. With the lack of real casualties, it was a lovely thing to watch as the blinking yellow dead lights lit up one by one. Then he had to answer the question.
Dreadful. We faced the task of rebuilding everything from the ground up.
Diggs turned.
Well, sir, that's where I came in at.
At least you don't have to deal with drugs, the American thought.
He could remember being a new second lieutenant, and afraid to enter barracks without sidearms. If the Russians had made their move in the early 1970s...
You really want to use our model?
Perhaps.
The only thing the Americans got wrong, and right, was that the Red Force allowed tactical initiative for its subunit commanders, something the Soviet Army would never have done. But, combined with doctrine developed by the Voroshilov Academy, the results were plain to see. That was something to remember, and Bondarenko had broken rules in his own tactical encounters, which was one reason why he was a living three-star instead of a dead colonel. He was also the newly appointed chief of operations for the Russian Army.
The problem is money, of course.
I've heard that song before, General. Diggs allowed himself a rueful chuckle.
Bondarenko had a plan for that. He wanted to cut the size of his army by 50%, and the money saved would go directly into training the remaining half. The results of such a plan he could see before him. Traditionally, the Soviet army had depended on mass, but the Americans had proven both here and in Iraq that training was master of the battlefield. As good as their equipment was, he'd get his materiel briefing tomorrow, he envied Diggs his personnel more than anything. Proof of that arrived the moment he formed the thought.
General?
The new arrival saluted.
Black Horse, we stripped their knickers right off.
This is Colonel Al Ham. He's CEO of the 11th. His second tour here. He used to be Op 4 Operations Officer.
Don't play cards with him, Diggs warned.
The general is too kind. Welcome to the desert, General Bondarenko.
Ham extended a large hand.
Your attack was well executed, Colonel.
The Russian examined him.
Thank you, sir. I have some great kids working for me. Blue Force was overly tentative. We caught them between two chairs, Ham explained.
He looked like a Russian, Bondarenko thought, tall and meaty, with a pale, florid complexion surrounding twinkling blue eyes. For this occasion, Ham was dressed in his old Russian-style uniform, complete with a red star on the tanker's beret, and his pistol belt outside the overlong blouse. It didn't quite make the Russian feel at home, but he appreciated the respect the Americans showed him.
"Diggs, you were right. Blue should have done everything to get here first. But you made them start too far back to make that option seem attractive."
"Well, that's the problem with battlefields," Ham answered for his boss. "Too much of the time they choose you instead of the other way around. That's lesson number one for the boys of the 5th Mech. If you let anybody else define the terms of the battle, well, it isn't much fun."
Chapter 5. Arrangements.
It turned out that both Sato and his co-pilot had donated blood for purposes of helping casualties in the abortive war with America, and the blessedly small numbers of wounded had never called that blood into use. Located by computer search by the Japanese Red Cross, samples had been obtained by the police and dispatched by messenger to Washington, via Vancouver. Japanese commercial aircraft were, understandably, still not permitted to fly into the United States, even Alaska, and an Air Force VC-20 from there to Washington. The courier was a senior police officer, with the aluminum case handcuffed to his left wrist. A trio of FBI agents met him at Andrews and drove him to the Hoover Building at 10th and Pennsylvania. The FBI's DNA lab took the samples and went to work to compare them with blood and other tissue specimens from the bodies. They already had matches for the blood types, and the results of the tests seemed a foregone conclusion, which would nonetheless be treated as though they were the only tenuous clue in a baffling case. Dan Murray, the acting director, wasn't exactly a slave to the book in criminal investigations, but for the purposes of this case, the book was holy writ. Backing him up were Tony Caruso, back from his vacation and working around the clock to head up the Bureau's side of the investigation, Pat O'Day in his capacity as roving inspector, and a cast of hundreds, if not quite thousands yet. Murray met the Japanese representative in the director's conference room. He, too, found it hard to move into Bill Shaw's office right away.
"We are performing our own tests," Chief Inspector Jisaburo Tanaka said, checking his watches. He had decided to wear two, one each, for Tokyo and Washington time. "They will be faxed here as soon as they are completed." Then he opened his briefcase again. "Here is our reconstruction of Captain Sato's schedule for the last week. Notes of interviews with family members and colleagues. Background on his life."
"Fast work. Thank you."
Murray took the pages, not quite sure what to do next. It was clear that his visitor wanted to say more. Murray and Tanaka had never met, but the word on his guest was impressive enough. A skilled and experienced investigator, Tanaka had specialized in political corruption violations, a specialty that had kept him very busy. Tanaka had the Cromwellian look of such a policeman. His professional life had turned him into a priest of the sort used by the Spanish to burn people at the stake. That made him perfect for this case.
"You will have our total cooperation. In fact, if you wish to send a senior official from your agency to oversee our investigation, I am authorized to tell you that we will welcome it."
He paused for a few seconds, looking down before proceeding.
"This is a disgrace for my country. The way those people used us all."
For a representative of a country incorrectly known for its lack of emotional display, Tanaka was a surprise. His hands balled tightly, and his dark eyes burned with anger. From the conference room, both men could look down Pennsylvania Avenue to a Capitol Hill scarred by the crash, still lit in the pre-dawn darkness by the hundreds of work lights.
"The co-pilot was murdered," Murray said. "Maybe that would help a little."
"Oh?"
Dan nodded.
"Stabbed. And it appears as though that took place prior to the takeoff. It appears at the moment that Sato acted alone, at least as far as flying the airplane was concerned."
The lab had already determined that the weapon used was a thin-bladed steak knife with a serrated edge, of the sort used on the airline.
As long as he'd been in the investigative business, it still amazed Murray what the lab techs could discern.
I see. That makes sense, Tanaka observed. The co-pilot's wife is pregnant, with twins, in fact. She is in the hospital now under close observation. What we have learned to date makes him appear to be a devoted husband and a man of no special political interests. My people thought it unlikely that he would end his life in this way.
Did Sato have any connections with... A shake of the head.
None that we have found. He flew one of the conspirators to Saipan, and they spoke briefly. Aside from that, Sato was an international pilot. His friends were his colleagues. He lived quietly in a modest house near Narita International Airport. But his brother was a senior officer in the Maritime Self-Defense Force, and his son was a fighter pilot. Both died during the hostilities.
Murray already knew that. Motive and opportunity. He scribbled a note to have the legal attaché in Tokyo take up the offer to participate in the Japanese investigation. But he'd have to get approval from justice and or state about that. For damn sure, the offer seemed sincere enough.
Good.
Love the traffic, Chavez observed. They were coming up I-95, passing the Springfield Mall. Normally, at this time of day, it was still dark, the highway was wall-to-wall with bureaucrats and lobbyists. Not today, though John and Ding had been called in, confirming their essential status to any who might have doubted it. Clark didn't respond, and the junior officer continued. "How do you suppose Dr. Ryan is doing?"
John grunted and shrugged. "Probably rolling with the punches. Better him than me."
"Rajo, Mr. C. All my friends at George Mason are going to have a fine old time."
"Think so?"
"John, he's got a government to rebuild. This will be a textbook case in real life. Ain't nobody ever done that before, Mano. You know what we're going to find out?"
A nod. "Yeah, if this place really works or not." "Better him than me," John thought again.
They'd been called in for their mission debriefing on operations in Japan. That was ticklish enough. Clark had been in the business for quite a while, but not long enough to be especially happy about telling others the things he'd done. He and Ding had killed, not for the first time, and now they'd get to describe it in detail to people, most of whom had never even held a gun, much less fired one in anger. Secrecy oaths or not, some of them might talk some day, the least consequence of which would be embarrassing revelations in the press. Somewhere in the middle came sworn testimony before a congressional committee. Well, not any time soon on that, John corrected himself. Questioning under oath, and the necessity of answering questions from people who didn't understand any better than the CIA weenies who sat at desks and judged people in the field for a living. The worst case was an actual prosecution, because while the things he had done weren't exactly illegal, they weren't exactly legal either. Somehow the Constitution and the United States Code annotated had never quite reconciled themselves with the activities the government carried out but did not wish to admit in open fora. Though his conscience was clear on that and many other things, his views on tactical morality wouldn't strike everyone as reasonable. Probably Ryan would understand, though. That was something.
"What's new this morning?" Jack asked.
"We expect recovery operations to be completed by this evening, sir."
It was Pat O'Day doing the morning FBI brief. He'd explained that Murray was busy. The inspector passed over a folder with the numbers of bodies recovered. Ryan gave it a quick scan. How the hell was he supposed to eat breakfast with such facts before him, the president wondered. Fortunately, there was just coffee at the moment.
"What else?"
"Things seem to be dropping into place. We've recovered what we think is the body of the co-pilot. He was murdered hours before the crash, leading us to believe that the pilot acted alone. We'll be doing DNA tests on the remains to confirm identities."
The inspector flipped through his notes, not trusting to memory to get things right.
Drug and alcohol tests on both bodies proved negative. Analysis of the flight data recorder, tapes of radio traffic, radar tapes, everything we've managed to pull together, it all leads to the same picture. One guy acting alone. Dan's meeting with a senior Japanese cop right now. Next step? It will be a textbook investigation process. We reconstruct everything Sato, that's the pilot's name, did over the last month or so, and take it back from there. Phone records, where he went, whom he saw, friends and associates, diary if any, everything we can get our hands on. The idea is to rebuild the guy completely and determine if he was part of any possible conspiracy. It will take time. It's a fairly exhaustive process. Best guess for now? Jack asked. One guy acting alone, O'Day said again, rather more positively this time. It's too damned early for any conclusion, Andrea Price objected. O'Day turned. It's not a conclusion. Mr. Ryan asked for a best guess. I've been in the investigation business for quite a while. This looks like a fairly elaborate impulse crime. The method of the co-pilot's murder, for example. He didn't even move the body out of the cockpit. He apologized to the guy right after he stabbed him, according to the tapes. Elaborate impulse crime, Andrea objected. Airline pilots are highly organized people, O'Day replied. Things that would be highly complex for the layman are as natural to them as pulling up your zipper. Most assassinations are carried out by dysfunctional individuals who get lucky. In this case, unfortunately, we had a very capable subject who largely made his own luck. In any event, that's what we have at the moment. For this to have been a conspiracy, what would you look for? Jack asked. Sir, successful criminal conspiracies are difficult to achieve under the best of circumstances. Price bristled again, but Inspector O'Day went on. The problem is human nature. The most normal of us are boastful. We like to share secrets to show how bright we are. Most criminals talk their way right into prison one way or another. Okay, in a case like this, we're not talking about your average robber, but the principle holds. To build any sort of conspiracy takes time and talk, and as a result, things leak. Then there's the problem of selecting the shooter, for want of a better term. Such time did not exist. The joint session was set up too late for much in the way of discussions to have taken place. The nature of the co-pilot's murder is very suggestive of a spur-of-the-moment method. A knife is less sure than a gun, and a steak knife isn't a good weapon, too easily bent or broken on a rib. How many murders have you handled? Price asked. Enough. I've assisted on plenty of local police cases, especially here in D.C. The Washington field office has backed up the D.C. police for years. Anyway, for Sato to have been the shooter in a conspiracy, he would have had to meet with people. We can track his free time, and we'll do that with the Japanese. But to this point, there is not a single indicator that way. Quite the contrary. All circumstances point to someone who saw a unique opportunity and made use of it on an impulse. What if the pilot wasn't... Miss Price, the cockpit tapes go back before the takeoff from Vancouver. We voice-printed everything in our own lab. It's a digital tape, and the sound quality is beautiful. The same guy who took off from Narita flew the airplane into the ground here. Now, if it wasn't Sato, then why didn't the co-pilot, they flew together as a team, notice? Conversely, if the pilot and co-pilot were show-ups, then both were part of the conspiracy from the beginning. Then why was the co-pilot murdered prior to takeoff from Vancouver? The Canadians are interviewing the rest of the crew for us, and all the service personnel say that the flight crew was just who they were supposed to be. The DNA ID process will prove that beyond doubt. Inspector, you are very persuasive, Ryan observed. Sir, this investigation will be rather involved, what with all the facts that have to be checked out, but the meat of the issue is fairly simple. It's damned hard to fake a crime scene. There's just too many things we can do. Is it theoretically possible to set things up in such a way as to fool our people, O'Day asked rhetorically. Yes, sir, maybe it is. But to do that would take months of preparation, and they didn't have months. It really comes down to one thing. The decision to call the joint session happened while that aircraft was over mid-Pacific.
Much as she wanted to, Price couldn't counter that argument. She'd run her own quick investigation on Patrick O'Day. Emil Jacobs had reinstituted the post of roving inspector years before, and collected people who preferred investigation to management. O'Day was an agent for whom running a field division had little appeal. He was part of a small team of experienced investigators who worked out of the director's office, an unofficial inspectorate which went into the field to keep an eye on things, mainly sensitive cases. He was a good cop who hated desk work, and Price had to concede that he knew how to run an investigation. Better yet, was someone outside the chain of command who wouldn't ham things up in order to get a promotion. The inspector had driven to the house in a 4x4 pickup. He wore cowboy boots, she noticed, and probably wanted publicity about as much as he wanted the pox. So Assistant Director Tony Caruso, titularly in charge of the investigation, would report to the Department of Justice, but Patrick O'Day would short-circuit the chain to report directly to Murray, who would in turn farm O'Day to the President so as to garner personal favor. She'd figured Murray for a sharp operator. Bill Shaw, after all, had used him as a personal troubleshooter. And Murray's loyalty would be to the institution of the FBI. A man could have a worse agenda, she admitted to herself. For O'Day, it was simpler still. He investigated crimes for a living, and while he appeared to jump too quickly to conclusions, this transplanted cowboy was doing it all by the book. You had to watch the good old boys. They were so good at hiding their smarts. But he would never have made the detail, she consoled herself. Enjoy your vacation. Mary Pat Foley was either in very early or in very late, Clark saw. It came to him again that of all the senior people in government, President Ryan was probably getting the most sleep, little though that might be. It was a hell of a way to run a railroad. People simply didn't perform well when denied rest for an extended period of time, something he'd learned the hard way in the field. But put a guy into high office and he immediately forgot that. Such pedestrian items as human factors faded into the mist. And then a month later, they wondered how they'd screwed up so bad. But that was usually after they got some poor line animal killed in the field. MP, when the hell is the last time you slept? Not many people could talk to her that way, but John had been her training officer once upon a time. A wan smile. John, you're not Jewish, and you're not my mother. Clark looked around. Where's Ed? On his way back from the Gulf. Conference with the Saudis, she explained. Though Mrs. Foley technically ranked Mr. Foley, Saudi culture wasn't quite ready to deal with a female king spook. Queen spook, John corrected himself with a smile. And Ed was probably better on the conferences anyway. Anything I need to know about? She shook her head. Routine. So, Domingo, did you drop the question? You're playing rough this morning, Clark observed before his partner could speak. Chavez just grinned. The country might be in turmoil, but some things were more important. Could be worse, Mr. C. I'm not a lawyer, am I? There goes the neighborhood, John grumbled. Then it was time for business. How's Jack doing? I'm scheduled to see him after lunch, but it wouldn't surprise me if they canceled out. The poor bastard must be buried alive. What I saw about how he got roped into this is what the paper said true? Yes, it is. So we have a Kelly girl for president, the deputy director, operations, posed as a multifaceted inside joke. We're going to do a comprehensive threat assessment. I want you two in on it. Why us? Chavez asked. Because I'm tired of having all that done by the Intelligence Directorate. I tell you one thing that's going to happen. We have a president now who understands what we do here.
We're going to beef up operations to the point where I can pick up a phone, ask a question, and get an answer I can understand.
Plan Blue? Clark asked, and received a welcome nod.
Blue had been his last function before leaving the CIA's training facility, known as the Farm, down near the Navy's nuclear weapons locker at Yorktown, Virginia. Instead of hiring a bunch of Ivy League intellectuals, at least they didn't smoke pipes anymore, he had proposed that the agency recruit cops, police officers right off the street. Cops, he reasoned, knew about using informants, didn't have to be taught street smarts, and knew about surviving in dangerous areas. All of that would save training dollars and probably produce better field officers. The proposal had been file-13'd by two successive DDOs, but Mary Pat had known about it from the beginning and approved the concept.
Can you sell it?
John, you're going to help me sell it. Look how well Domingo here has turned out.
You mean I'm not affirmative action? Chavez asked.
No, Ding, that's only with his daughter, Mrs. Foley suggested. Ryan will go for it. He isn't very keen on the director. Anyway, for now I want you two to do your debrief on Sandalwood.
What about our cover? Clark asked.
He didn't have to explain what he meant. Mary Pat had never got her hands dirty in the field. She was espionage, not the paramilitary side of the operations directorate. But she understood just fine.
John, you were acting under presidential orders. That's written down and in the book. Nobody's going to second-guess anything you did, especially with saving Koga. You both have an intelligence star coming for that. President Durling wanted to see you and present the medals himself up at Camp David. I suppose Jack will, too.
Whoa, Chavez thought behind unblinking eyes. But nice as that thought was, he'd been thinking about something else on the 3-hour drive up from Yorktown.
When's the threat assessment start?
Tomorrow, for our side of it. Why? MP asked.
Ma'am, I think we're going to be busy.
I hope you're wrong, she replied, after nodding.
I have 2 procedures scheduled for today, Kathy said, surveying the breakfast buffet. Since they didn't know what the Ryans liked to have in the morning, the staff had prepared some, actually quite a lot, of everything. Sally and little Jack thought that was just great. Even better, schools were closed. Katie, a recent graduate to Real Foods, gnawed at a piece of bacon in her hand while contemplating some buttered toast. For children, the immediate has the greatest importance. Sally, now 15, going on 30, her father sometimes lamented, took the longest view of the 3, but at the moment that was limited to how her social life would be affected. For all of them, Daddy was still Daddy, whatever job he might hold at the moment. They'd learn different, Jack knew, but one thing at a time.
"We haven't figured that out," her husband replied, selecting scrambled eggs and bacon for his plate. "He'd need his energy today."
"Jack, the deal was that I could still do my work, remember?"
"Mrs. Ryan?"
It was Andrea Price, still hovering around like a guardian angel, albeit with an automatic pistol.
"We're still figuring out the security issues, and—"
"My patients need me. Jack, Bernie Katz and Hal Marsh can backstop me on a lot of things, but one of my patients today needs me.
I have teaching rounds to prep for, too." She checked her watch.
"In 4 hours." Which was true, Ryan didn't have to ask. Professor Carolyn Ryan, M.D., FACS, was top gun for driving a laser around a retina. People came from all over the world to watch her work.
"But schools are—" Price stopped, reminding herself that she knew better.
"Not medical schools. We can't send patients home."
"I'm sorry. I know how complicated things are for everybody, but I have people who depend on me, too, and I have to be there for them."
Kathy looked at the adult faces in the kitchen for a decision that would go her way. The kitchen staff, all sailors, moved in and out like mobile statues, pretending not to hear anything. The Secret Service people adopted a different blank expression, one with more discomfort in it. The First Lady was supposed to be an unpaid adjunct to her husband. That was a rule which needed changing at some point. Sooner or later, after all, there would be a female president, and that would really upset the apple cart, a fact well known but studiously ignored to this point in American history. The usual political wife was a woman who appeared at her husband's side with an adoring smile and a few carefully picked words, who endured the tedium of a campaign and the surprisingly brutal handshakes. Certainly Kathy Ryan would not subject her surgeon's hands to that, Price thought suddenly. But this First Lady actually had a job. More than that, she was a physician with a Lasker Memorial Public Service Award shortly to sit on her mantle. The awards dinner had yet to be held. And if she had learned anything about Kathy Ryan, Price knew that she was dedicated to her profession, not merely to her husband. However admirable that might be, it would be a royal pain in the ass to the service, Price was sure. Worse yet, the principal agent assigned to Mrs. Dr. Ryan was Roy Altman, a tall bruiser of a former paratrooper whom she'd not yet met. That decision had been made for Roy's size as well as his savvy. It never hurt to have one obvious bodyguard close aboard. And since the First Lady appeared to many as a soft target, one of Roy's functions was to make the casual troublemaker think twice on that basis alone. Other members of her detail would be virtually invisible. One of Altman's other functions was to use his bulk to block bullets, something the agents trained for but didn't dwell on. Each of the Ryan kids would have to be protected as well, in a sub-detail that routinely split into segments. Katie's had been the hardest to select, because agents had fought for the job. The boss there would be the oldest member of the team, a grandfather named Don Russell. Little Jack would get a youngish male principal who was a serious sports fan, while Sally Ryan drew a female agent just over 30, single, and hip, Price's term rather than the agent's, wise in the ways of young men and mall shopping. The idea was to make the family as comfortable as was possible with the necessity of being followed everywhere except the bathroom by people with loaded firearms and radios. It was, in the end, a hopeless task, of course. President Ryan had the background to accept the need for all of this. His family would learn to endure it. "Dr. Ryan, when will you have to leave?" Price asked. "About 40 minutes. It depends on traff—" "Not any more," Price corrected the First Lady. The day would be bad enough. The idea had been to use the previous day to brief the Vice President's family in on all the things that had to be done. But that plan had been shot completely to hell, along with so many other things. Altman was in another room going over maps. There were three viable land routes to Baltimore: Interstate 95, the Baltimore-Washington Parkway, and U.S. Route 1, all of them packed every morning with rush-hour traffic, which a Secret Service convoy would disrupt to a fare-thee-well. Worse, for any potential assassin, the routes were too predictable, narrowing down as they did on nearing Baltimore. Johns Hopkins Hospital had a helicopter pad atop its pediatrics building, but nobody had yet considered the political fallout that could result from hopping the First Lady to work every day in a Marine Corps VH-60. Maybe that was a viable option now, Price decided. She left the room to confer with Altman, and suddenly the Ryan family was alone, having breakfast as though they were still a normal family.
"My God, Jack," Kathy breathed.
"I know." Instead of talking, they enjoyed the silence for a full minute, both of them looking down at their breakfast, poking things around with forks instead of eating.
"The kids need clothes for the funeral," Kathy said finally.
"Tell Andrea."
"Okay." "Do you know when it'll be?"
"I should find out today."
"I'll still be able to work, right?"
With Price gone, she could allow her concern to show. Jack looked up.
"Yes. Look, I'm going to try my best to keep us as normal as we can, and I know how important your work is.
Matter of fact, I haven't had much chance to tell you what I think of that prize you just bagged.
He smiled.
I'm damn proud of you, babe.
Price came back in.
Dr. Ryan, she said.
And, of course, both heads turned. They could see it on her face. The most basic of issues hadn't been discussed yet. Did they call her Dr. Ryan, Mrs. Ryan, or...
Make it easier on everyone, okay? Call me Kathy.
Price couldn't do that, but she let it slide for the moment.
Until we figure things out, we'll fly you there. The Marines have a helicopter on the way here.
Isn't that expensive? Kathy asked.
Yes, it is, but we have to figure out procedures and things, and for the moment this is the easiest thing to do. Also,
a very large man came into the room.
This is Roy Altman. He'll be your principal agent for a while.
Oh, was all Kathy was able to say at the moment.
6 feet 3 and 220 pounds of Roy Altman came into the room. He had thinning blonde hair, pale skin, and a sheepish expression that made him seem embarrassed by his bulk. Like all Secret Service agents, his suit coat was cut a little big to help conceal his service automatic, and in his particular case, hiding a machine gun would have been fairly easy. Altman came over to shake her hand, which he did with considerable delicacy.
"Ma'am, you know what my job is. I'll try to keep as much out of the way as possible."
Two more people came into the room. Altman introduced them as the rest of her detail for the day. All of them were temporary. They all had to get along with their principal, and that wasn't all so easy to predict, even with amiable principals, as all the Ryans seemed thus far to be. Kathy was tempted to ask if all this was really necessary, but she knew better. On the other hand, how would she shepherd this mob around the Maumani building? She traded a look with her husband and reminded herself that they would not be in this unhappy predicament had she not agreed to Jack's elevation to the vice presidency, which had lasted all of, what, 5 minutes? Maybe not even that long. Just then came the roar of the Sikorsky Black Hawk helicopter, landing up the hill from the house and creating a mini-blizzard on what had once been the site of a small astronomical observatory. Her husband looked at his watch and realized that the Marines of VMH-1 were indeed operating off a short fuse. How long, he wondered, before the smothering attention drove them all mad. "This shot is live from the grounds of the Naval Observatory on Massachusetts Avenue," the NBC reporter said, cued by the director. "That looks like one of the Marine helicopters. I suppose the President is going somewhere." The camera zoomed in as the snow cloud settled down somewhat. "An American Black Hawk, extensively modified," the intelligence officer said. "See there? That's a black hole infrared suppression system to protect against ground-to-air missiles that track engine heat."
"How effective?"
"Very, but not against laser-guided weapons," he added. "Nor is it useful against guns." No sooner had the aircraft's main rotor stopped turning than a squad of Marines surrounded it. "I need a map of the area. Wherever that camera is, a mortar would also be effective. The same is true of the White House grounds, of course." And anybody they knew could use a mortar, all the more so with the new laser-guided rounds first developed by the British and soon thereafter copied by the rest of the world. In a way, it was the Americans who showed the way. It was their aphorism, after all. If you can see it, you can hit it. If you can hit it, you can kill it. And everyone inside of it, whatever it might be. With that thought, a plan began to form. He checked his watch, which had a stopwatch function button, placing his finger there and waiting. The TV director, 6,000 miles away, had nothing better to do than keep on that long-lens camera. Presently, a large vehicle approached the helicopter and 4 people got out. They walked right to the aircraft, whose crewman held the sliding door open.
"That's Mrs. Ryan," the commentator said. "She's a surgeon at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore."
"You suppose she's flying to work?" the reporter asked.
"We'll know in a minute."
Which was about right.
The intelligence officer pushed the watch button the moment the door closed. The rotor started turning a few seconds later, building power from the two turbine engines, and then the helicopter lifted off, nose down as they all did, gaining altitude as it headed off, probably to the north. He checked his watch to see the elapsed time from door close to liftoff. This aircraft had a military crew, and they would take pride in doing everything the same way every time. More than enough time for a mortar round to travel three times the necessary distance, he judged. It was her first time in a helicopter. They had Kathy sit in the jump seat behind and between the two pilots. They didn't tell her why. The Black Hawk's rugged airframe was designed to absorb fully 14 Gs in the event of a crash, and this seat was statistically the safest in the bird. The four-bladed rotor made for a smooth ride, and about the only objection she had to the experience was the cold. No one had yet designed a military aircraft with an efficient heating system. It would have been enjoyable but for the lingering embarrassment, and the fact that the Secret Service agents were scanning out the doors, obviously looking for some sort of danger or other. It was becoming clear that they could take the fun out of anything. "I guess she's commuting to work," the reporter decided. The camera had tracked the VH-60 until it disappeared into the tree line. It was a rare moment of levity. All of the networks were doing the same thing they'd done after the assassination of John Kennedy. Every single regular show was off the air, while the networks devoted every waking hour, 24 hours per day now, which had not been the case in 1963, to coverage of the disaster and its aftermath. What that really meant was a bonanza for the cable channels, as had been proven by tracking information through the various rating systems. But the networks had to be responsible, and doing this was responsible journalism. "Well, she is a physician, isn't she? It's easy to forget that, despite the disaster that has overtaken our government, outside the Beltway, there are still people who do real work. Babies are being born. Life goes on," the commentator observed pontifically, as was his job. "And so does the country." The reporter looked directly at the camera for the transition to commercial. He didn't hear the voice from so far away. "For now." The kids were shepherded away by their bodyguards, and the real work of the day began. Arnie Van Dam looked like hell. He was about to hit the wall, Jack decided. The combination of grueling work and grief was about to destroy the man. All well and good that the president should be spared as much as possible, Ryan knew, but not at the cost of wrecking the people upon whom he depended so much. "Say your piece, Arnie, then disappear for a while and get some rest." "You know I can't do that." "Andrea?"
"Yes, Mr. President."
"When we've finished here, have somebody drive Arnie home. You will not allow him back in the house until 4 this afternoon." Ryan shifted his gaze. "Arnie, you will not burn out on me. I need you too much." The chief of staff was too tired to show any gratitude. He handed over a folder. "Here are the plans for the funeral day after tomorrow." Ryan flipped open the folder, his demeanor deflated as suddenly as he had exercised another dollop of presidential authority. Whoever had put the plan together had been clever and sensitive about it. Maybe somewhere there had been a contingency plan for this sort of thing, a question Ryan would never bring himself to ask. But whatever the truth was, someone had done well. Roger and Ann Derling would lie in state in the White House, since the Capitol Rotunda was not available. And for 24 hours people would be allowed to walk through, entering through the front, and exiting from the east wing. The sadness of the event would be muted for the mourners by later exposure to the Americana and presidential portraits. The Derlings would be taken by hearse to National Cathedral the next morning, along with three members of the Congress, a Jew, a Protestant, and a Catholic, for the interdenominational memorial service.
Ryan had two major speeches to give. The text of both was in the back of the folder.
What's that for?
Kathy was wearing a crash helmet with full connections into the helicopter's intercom. She pointed at another aircraft 50 yards to their right rear.
We always fly with a backup aircraft, ma'am, in case something breaks and we have to land, the pilot explained from the right front seat. We don't want to delay you unnecessarily.
He didn't say that in the backup helicopter were four more Secret Service agents with heavier weapons.
How often does that happen, Colonel?
Not since I've been around, ma'am.
Nor did he say that one of the Marine Blackhawks had crashed into the Potomac in 1993, killing all hands. Well, it had been a long time. The pilot's eyes were scanning the air constantly. Part of VMH-1's institutional memory was what had seemed to be an attempted ramming over the California home of President Reagan. In fact, it had been a screw-up by a careless private pilot. After his interview with the Secret Service, the poor bastard had probably given up flying entirely. They were the most humorless people, Colonel Hank Goodman knew from long experience. The air was clear and cold, but pretty smooth. He controlled the stick with his fingertips as they followed I-95 northeast. Baltimore was already in view, and he knew the approach into Hopkins well enough from previous duty at Naval Air Station Patuxent River, whose Navy and Marine helos occasionally helped fly accident victims. Hopkins, he remembered, got the pediatric trauma cases for the state's critical care system. The same sobering thought hit Kathy when they flew past the University of Maryland's shock trauma building. This wasn't her first flight in a helicopter, was it? It was just that for the other one she'd been unconscious. People had tried to kill her and Sally, and all the people around her were in jeopardy if somebody else made another try. Why? Because of who her husband was.
Mr. Altman, Kathy heard over the intercom.
Yeah, Colonel?
You called ahead, right?
Yes, they know we're coming, Colonel, Altman assured him.
No, I mean, is the roof checked out for a 60?
What do you mean?
I mean this bird is heavier than the one the state troopers use. Is the pad certified for us?
Silence provided the answer.
Colonel Goodman looked over at his co-pilot and grimaced.
Okay, we can handle that this one time.
Clear left.
Clear right, Goodman replied.
He circled once, checking the windsock on the roof of the building below. Just puffs of wind from the northwest. The descent was gentle, and the colonel kept a close eye on the radio whips to his right. He touched down soft, keeping his rotor turning to prevent the full weight of the aircraft from resting on the reinforced concrete roof. It probably wasn't necessary, of course. Civil engineers always put more strength into buildings than they actually needed. But Goodman hadn't made the rank of bird colonel by taking chances for the fun of it. His crew chief moved to pull the door open. The Secret Service agents went first, scanning the building while Goodman kept his hand on the collective, ready to yank up and rocket from the building. Then they helped Mrs. Ryan out, and he could get on with his day.
When we get back, call this place yourself and get the rating on the roof. Then ask for plans for our files.
Yes, sir. It just went too fast, sir.
Tell me about it.
He switched to the radio link.
Marine 3, Marine 2.
2, the orbiting backup aircraft responded at once.
On the go.
Goodman pulled the collective and angled south off the roof.
She seems nice enough.
Got nervous just before we landed, the crew chief observed.
So was I, Goodman said. I'll call them when we get back.
The Secret Service had called ahead to Dr. Katz, who was waiting inside, along with 3 Hopkins security officers. Introductions were exchanged. Name tags were passed out, making the 3 agents ostensible staff members of the medical school, and the day of Associate Professor Carolyn M. Ryan, M.D., FACS, began.
How's Mrs. Hart doing?
I saw her 20 minutes ago, Kathy. She's actually rather pleased to have the First Lady operating on her.
Professor Katz was surprised at Professor Ryan's reaction.